Jane Oates joins us, a senior policy advisor and recent president at WorkingNation.com. Welcome back, Jane.
I am here. Can you hear me?
Good. Now we're rolling. 177,000 jobs added in April. A better number than expected, right?
Much better number. Really strong number for April.
What do you make of that?
Well, you know, look, there's things that I would say. Healthcare just keeps booming along. I mean, they added 51,000 jobs this in April, and 22,000 of those were in hospitals, in a lot of healthcare space. But the second thing could just be temporary. I don't want to, you know, rain on a good jobs number. You know, transportation and warehousing was up 29,000 jobs, and the average over the last year has been about 10,000. You know, so is that because people, well, we heard the auto industry last month doubling down on getting their goods in before a tariff hit? I don't know. I mean, let's hope it's a strong number that continues a trend through the rest of the year, but just warning that that might be a one-time wonder number.
That's interesting because we have wondered about that with some retailers stocking up on items. And so some of the numbers continue to be good, but that might just be ordering more than they really are selling right now in anticipation of tariffs. But I wouldn't say that healthcare would be subject to that, right? It's not like people Jane. I don't see how healthcare would be subject to that.
No. Healthcare, you know, this has been going on for 5 years. They have just so strong and continue that growth. So, I mean, obviously they're adding jobs because either we're getting sicker or we're doing our best to stay healthier. I don't know which it is, but I'll take either one because that's a really strong 51,000 is a lot of jobs to add in 1 month.
And then you said transportation and warehousing was plus 29,000. But again, that may be hiring extra shifts or working people more just in anticipation of what's coming. Then 24,000 jobs were added in hospitality. It would seem to me like that would be a challenged sector if we have a recession or if the trade wars continue.
Yeah, I think that was a really surprising number to me, John, because, you know, you think as people tighten their belts a little bit, as they start to get worried about their job security, they might, you know, do less entertainment, but it doesn't seem to, you know, you and I have talked about this for so long now. The real engine of this economy is consumer spending, and we are still spending.
Yeah, I know. I hesitate to applaud that because I think Americans do outspend their means. Another thing that we've talked about a lot is we've been waiting for all of these DOGE federal job cuts to start to show up in the jobs numbers. Are they starting to show up?
So we saw a downturn of 9,000 federal jobs in April. So that brings the 2025 total to an overall loss of 26,000 jobs. So, you know, we still have a lot of federal workers who are on administrative leave. That doesn't count. We still have some that are collecting severance. They don't count in the number either. So I expect that number to continue to be a factor in the jobs as we close 2025. But I think it won't be a cliff. It'll be a cascade.
Well, in March, the federal jobs shrunk by a number of 3,800. And then, let's see, no, that was March. March was minus 3,800. And then April is minus 9,000.
Yeah.
So you do start to maybe see them cascading in, as you say. I do want to ask you also just about manufacturing in general in a minute. It's 12:15 now. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, and we're talking to Jane Oates of Working Nation. The manufacturing jobs were off a little bit in this jobs number, correct, Jane?
Yes, they were. And, you know, manufacturing has continued, in my opinion, really underperform in 2025. And, you know, I am a lover of manufacturing. I want to see it be robustly active and growing every month. But it just doesn't seem to be that way. Although, you know, earlier this week, the productivity numbers came out and they were really strong.
What does that mean?
It means that fewer people are doing more.
And so it does make me wonder.
Their numbers.
Yeah, right. And I think that's a function of automation and technology and robotics and things like that, right?
And I think talent. I think that we just have a really talented workforce in manufacturing, and they just, you know, rise to the challenge. But I wish we could hire.
We're going to hang in there as long as we can with you, Jane. You've been cutting in and out, but let's just continue. And if I have to say thank you, I will. I just wonder, though, because there's been so much emphasis on reshoring manufacturing in America, if that is and if that is where the focus should be, and maybe it well should be, a lot of money to be made making cars and great big things. But I wonder if manufacturing is necessarily the future of American productivity.
Well, I hope it is, John, because those are great jobs. But I think what we've had, by the way, this is not a political statement from everybody on both sides of the aisle, is a lot of talk and very little action. So I hope we get to some action soon to really bring these jobs back.
What does that mean to you?
Well, it means to me employers standing up and saying, if this happens, we can add this many jobs. So for a local manufacturer, it means I can add a third shift, and therefore I'm going to add the people to, you know, to fill that third shift. And that means that big manufacturers to small, you know, to their subs, are going to have to really feel confident in the economy and confident in this, what you and I just talked about, that Americans will keep spending money. They'll keep buying cars. They'll keep buying clothes. They'll keep buying, you know, goods that have to be replaced.
Well, with 177,000 jobs added in April, would you say that this is true, that the managers of all of these companies in America have not yet decided what the future is? They're on pause. They certainly haven't been cutting back with big numbers. They who knows what the economy would be doing if we weren't in a trade war, but they have not made a negative decision yet. Is that true?
I think that's very true. And I think the one thing that most business people tell me is businesses love some kind of certainty. They don't care how bad things are as long as they know for certain that that is what it is. And I think this back and forth, you know, because we don't know what the tariffs are going to do. It could be positive. It could be negative. It could be somewhere in the middle. But changing the tariffs from 10% to 50% to 140% over the course of 3 days is the kind of destabilized environment that businesses really don't like. They can't plan. They can handle anything, but they just have to know what the rules are.
And the rule just changed this morning. We talked about this earlier on the de minimis exemption, which allows businesses that import items under $800 to not have to take pay a tariff on that. And the president said that's a loophole, and they've closed that down too. I hope somebody thinks that's a good idea, because I don't see how that's a positive for anybody.
Boy, I don't either, particularly for small businesses. And we've talked about this in the past, John. Small businesses really create jobs. They're the job creators. And, you know, if we start to tie their hands, I'm not sure where that takes us.
I wonder what the government number, when we talk about the 177,000 jobs added in April, up or down, whatever, when we talk about that number, does that include government employees?
That does include government employees. The number that you get earlier in the week, which is from ADP, the payroll contractor, that is only private sector. And very interestingly, their number this for April was 62,000. So there's a huge variance, and obviously the governments didn't make up for that variance. So I'm not quite sure what that is. It just could be timing. You know, one survey stopped earlier than another.
But wait a minute, you're saying 62,000 was a good number? That was a high number in the private sector?
No, that was a weak number, and that's the private sector number that ADP had from their payroll count. So I don't know why there's a discrepancy like that. 62,000 and 177,000 is a big discrepancy.
You wonder then if maybe some of these federal job cuts are eventually going to catch up with what you saw in that other number.
Well, although remember, those are jobs added. So I'm not quite sure. I can't explain it. I mean, it's usually like if ADP has 62,000 and then the federal and then the BLS number is like 177, that growth is in government. That wasn't the case this time. So I'm not quite sure what it is. I can't explain it yet, but I'm sure ADP will get on the phone to you and explain it for me.
Well, one last question for you, Jane, and that is, What's the next number that you're paying attention to? Is it interest rates? Is it the unemployment number, which is happily stuck at 4.2? What's the number that you're paying attention to?
You know what I'm looking for in a couple of weeks? The debt number, especially the credit card debt number. You know, I mean, that has been hitting new highs every month. And if that continues, that consumer spending. But you know what? I'm going to be positive because, you know, we are now in May. Lots of new graduates hitting the job market from high school, undergraduate and graduate school. Let's hope the numbers stay great for at least the next couple months. They have some. A real opportunity to begin their professional careers.
Jane Oates, Senior Policy Advisor over at Working Nation. Okay, Jane, always nice to talk to you.
Thank you, John. Great talking to you. Bye-bye.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. You may not know this, but May 4th through the 7th, there's another convention of sorts in town, and it has to do with risk management. We're going to talk a little bit about that, what that means, and what these people are seeing. Reed Sawyer is here, the head of the Emerging Risk Group at Marsh McLennan. Thanks for joining us, Reed. You're on WGN. How are you?
Yeah, fantastic. And thanks for having me on.
What's this group? What do you all do?
Yeah, so the Emerging Risk Group at Marsh McLennan, my team is focused around helping our clients connect risk and strategy and be able to help them price that risk so that they can make better decisions and the way that they see the world. And it's really timely given all the uncertainty that the companies are dealing with in today's environment.
So is this insurance then, right?
It is. It's related to insurance. And then how do we spend down, you know, help our clients spend down their risk and transfer that risk into the insurance markets? That's correct, John.
What are you insuring against? Is it disasters? Is it a down economy? What's the policy say?
Yeah, so it's a great question. So there's a range of insurance products out there that help our clients from everything from dealing with systemic cyber risk to physical asset risks on their property to how do we think about their people? How do we protect the financial balance sheets of our clients across that? And all the way down into trade uncertainty and political risk. So really a wide range of solution sets for companies to hedge their risk.
If somebody freezes your computers or your data and then they use ransomware to get it back, do you insure against that sort of thing? And is that an emerging area of concern?
Yeah, that's exactly. And there's a very robust cyber insurance market out there that addresses those types of issues and is not just an emerging concern, but something that we're dealing with and thinking about at significant levels. It's really starting to pose systemic risks to our clients out there and the way that they operate.
How do you determine what the value of that is? I could go through a warehouse and count pallets and say, here's how much we need to insure against. How do you come up with a number for data?
Yes, it's a fascinating question, John. And it's something that we spend a lot of time on. And there's sort of two components. The first is when you've got the luxury of being at a place like Marsh McLennan, where we've got the world's largest data set on these issues, right? That helps us then to draw in and to be able to price risk, not only just from the understanding of what type of risk, digital cyber risk, exists within in a company's value chain, if you will, but then our ability to be able to put models up against that and build simulations to ask the question of what might happen if you were to have an event in a certain part of the value chain of the client. And that, again, is that ability to be able to price risk and determine if should you insure it, should you spend more on your control environment. How do you really design this from a holistic resiliency perspective, if you will?
Do any of the policies include the option to pay the ransom guys?
They do, right? And it depends on, you know, that there's restrictions on that would be appropriate, right? If somebody, if the nefarious actor is on the known or designated list from Treasury, right, that you can't pay ransoms to those actors. But very real business concerns out there when you're talking about the loss of production or the inability to access data or to retrieve your data from these known threats.
Well, I'm taking you down this path, but maybe that's not what you guys are mostly talking about. You've got this event or this emerging markets or emerging risk of, what is it, a convention in Chicago, May 4th through the 7th. What are you all talking about at this conference?
Yeah, really excited that Chicago is hosting. It's just what we talk about. Its formal name is the Risk World Conference, and so we're going to have about 10,000 risk and finance professionals from across the Fortune 500 coming to Chicago. And so, again, great opportunity to showcase all that Chicago has. You know, there's going to be a set of themes that will be dominating the event with these organizations in town. Certainly cyber technology risk we were just talking about is going to be one of the headline risks discussed. But geopolitical risks and everything that the clients are facing internationally, rising tensions, multiple conflicts, right? All the uncertainty that comes with that. Certainly the macroeconomic environment is going to be a key theme, as well as supply chain risks, as you know, that is becoming, for some organizations, really existential, given the ongoing trade uncertainties.
10,000 people in Chicago, May 4th through the 7th for this?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It's going to be a fantastic event.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some restaurants out there that are happy to hear that, and I love it. You know, it's funny. It's a big enough city. When the DNC came to town, we all lost our minds that we were going to have 50,000 people, and I think what gets lost in that is we have 50,000 people often, 10,000, and who knew that the risk management people were going to be here? That's great for Chicago. So if, say, there is a tariff war or there's a shooting war, that hurts a business. Are you then trying to assess what the cost is to the business? And then what's the claim look like? Can they say, hey, we've lost business because tariffs are high, and therefore I want the insurance to pay me some money back? Does it work that way?
Yeah, it doesn't work quite that way in the fact that if a government policy is you know, on the tariffs, and then that rises costs or creates inflation from that perspective. But you could see from this, right, business interruption that's occurring, right, from some of the tariffs. And so there are certain ways or credit risk that then evolves because the tariffs are placing significant costs on upstream suppliers that could default or fail to provide goods or performance of the contracts. And those types of things can be insured. I think what's really interesting about this is, you know, Marsh McLennan, we did a survey recently and found that almost 74% of senior risk and finance professionals have very limited visibility of their supply chain risk that's below what's immediately obvious, right? Sort of right below what their immediate tier one suppliers would have. And when we looked into our digital supply chain platform, what we call Cent Risk, we did an analysis of about 120,000 suppliers, John, on this, and found that organizations typically have 150 times more hidden exposures on goods from China than what's currently visible. And so there's sort of two components to it. One is understanding the resiliency and where the insurance plays and doesn't play. But it's this idea that being more strategic and using, you know, this growing trend of using digital supply chain intelligence tools to be able to gain visibility and then understand what those costs are to be able to respond. And it's really this idea of this holistic picture between the insurance, the risk management function, and then how do we think about financing ways to become more resilient as we move through these uncertain times.
Well, we've been hearing about fewer cargo ships off the coast of Los Angeles. Are you hearing that there are supply chain interruptions coming?
Absolutely. I think that is evident as we've just gone through a primary section of earnings reports over the last couple of weeks, right across the Fortune 500, and the forecasts and the messages have been clear on how these disruptions are being forecasted. I think what's difficult, though, as we think about it, is it's really as these trade tensions continue to fluctuate across the key trade corridors, right? U.S., China, U.S., and the EU. is again, then what does that potentially mean as organizations are looking forward over the next 6 to 9 months, and how do they start to forecast the impact of these types of scenarios?
Do you do that? What do you tell them right now?
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple things. We do that. We do it with the use of a lot of AI and other techniques, but it's this idea that it's critical, more critical now than ever, to employ scenario planning, to be able to start to test business strategies under different conditions. Because when you're operating under conditions of uncertainty like this, if you can't put a price on the risk, it's incredibly hard to make a decision between whether I should increase on-hand inventory or move to a nearshoring perspective for my businesses. And so it's really about the idea of how do we build risk forecasts to then make better and informed decisions about the potential outcomes.
It's really interesting, Reid. We need to have you on more often. Reid is the head of Emerging Risk Group at Marsh McLennan. There's a conference coming into Chicago May 4th through the 7th. Let's connect maybe afterwards and catch up on what you all heard and what you all said.
Fantastic. I would love to, and thank you very much.
We welcome back Kara Demergen-Huss, who is the Senior Vice President at TCCI Manufacturing. We have talked to her about that business in Decatur where they make compressors and stuff like that. Kara, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me today, John.
Where are you today?
I am in Decatur today, Illinois. So I've been on a whirlwind of travel, but I'm touching my feet back home.
I understand you were at the Advanced Clean Transportation Expo. Is that right?
I was. It was a fantastic show this year in Anaheim, California, the ACT Expo, really talking about innovation and transforming the future of transportation.
Really? What does that mean? I mean, I know you make compressors, but what's the conversation or industry about there?
Yeah, I think there were a couple of big things, and, you know, listening in on part of what Reid was saying at Marsh, you know, we're seeing similar AI and innovation happening in the transportation industry, and that was a big part of the conversation and a lot of the sessions. We heard from CEOs and leaders at International, at Traton, who all spoke about kind of this shift in how we're thinking about software innovation and predictive intelligence that's reshaping our fleet performance in the transportation sector, and really how predictive maintenance and smart routing and safety enhancements can make a big difference in customer value, uptime, and fleet performance. So although these things don't directly impact the compressor production, it impacts our industry, and we at TCCI make compressors or part of the thermal management system, which really is the center source and critical role for improving battery performance, battery safety, and thinking about AI and predictive sensoring and modeling in our products as well.
Now, are you making the compressors that cool refrigerated trucks? What do you guys make?
We do that. We make compressors that cool the cabin and the battery cooling, but also in the refrigeration for the transport refrigeration industry as well.
In Decatur, how many people work at TCCI?
We have over 1,000 people that work at TCCI Manufacturing, and our new, we're really excited about our new Clean Energy Innovation Hub that we opened last week with the state of Illinois and our public-private partnership with Illinois and Richland Community College in the city of Decatur, so that we are onshoring domestic production of our EV components here in Illinois to strengthen the U.S. supply chain. But we're also really made some major announcements with the Illinois EPA and our advancements in natural refrigerant testing and the coming on board of our sustainable technology innovation with our climatic center. And then the third part of that is this workforce development piece with our Clean Energy Workforce Academy, where we're bringing associates in engineering degrees and bringing direct-to-career in HVAC and technicians and EV and hybrid technicians as well.
So is this trade war good for you guys if you are onshoring, if you're a domestic manufacturer, or is this bad for you?
You know, our big focus at TCCI is really global localization. We think about that as we structure our global operations so that we can mitigate any risks that, you know, are coming due to tariffs or supply chain disruptions or logistics costs. So really thinking about manufacturing in the regions where our customers are located, and our new clean energy innovation hub is a big part of that for our North American manufacturing.
Yeah, but I don't know what that means. I mean, I know what that means, but I don't know if that's positive or negative for you. If you're making stuff in Illinois, maybe you're making stuff outside the country too.
The component
parts come from overseas. If there's tariffs going both ways, it would seem you're a manufacturer. That's not good for you then, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are really some things that are concerning right now is, you know, as we think about making sure we have a good understanding of our costs on our materials and our components and where those are coming from. We do manufacture in other locations in China and India and now the U.S. So it's really important for us. And I think these tariffs bring a lot of uncertainties for us. We need some stable long-term trade policies rather than these short-term tariff shifts
so that
we can plan better.
Have you seen costs go up yet, or maybe you're just worried about that possibility?
We're definitely worried about that possibility in ours, and we're evaluating all of those costs right now and what these tariffs and the different countries are going to, you know, directly impact our production in our various locations. So we have our teams evaluating all of that right now. And it's a big concern for our customers as well, as I'm sure
One last question for you about that then.
Yeah.
Are you minimizing your, are you scaling back then as a result of that?
We currently are not scaling back. We are working with our customers right now to understand production levels and ensuring that we're working through the tariff situation in partnership with our customers. We're reviewing production schedules, but we are moving full steam ahead on all of our production facilities across the world.
Are you getting any indication that your suppliers will eat some of the increased costs? I wonder where that's going to land. Do you have a guess on that?
I think those are all great questions. We are in the process of having those conversations right now with our customers and with our suppliers as well. So I think those are all still things under negotiation right now.
Kara, it's always nice to talk to you, and we're just always happy to hear how well things are going at your place there in Decatur. Do join us again, and welcome back to Illinois.
Thanks so much for having me.